right. Good evening, everybody. Did I turn my mic on? Am I on? Okay. Well, we're coming back to our studies in the Old Testament in 2 Chronicles. And if you have a Bible, if you want to head over to 2 Chronicles chapter 3, we covered the first two chapters the first night. Remember, Chronicles, both 1 and 2 Chronicles were all one work at one time, but they were divided in two by the time that they made the Greek translation of the Bible, the Septuagint. It's a chronicle of Israel's earlier history as a kingdom that was written for the Jewish people that were coming back from the 70 years of exile in Babylon. So it's written by the priesthood, most likely written by Ezra, chronicled for them so that they understand the importance of the task that they're undertaking to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. Now, as we began the second part of the Chronicles last time, we read about Solomon's kingdom and how he took the throne, and the first thing that he did was to ask God for the wisdom to know how to run this kingdom. It was too much for him. He was just a kid, he said. And God granted that to him. And then when we left off last time, we had read about how Solomon had asked the king of Tyre to send over some skilled labor, basically. He needed an architect and a designer to help him build the temple. And then it described this huge workforce that went into building the temple, to creating this amazing project. Now tonight, we're going to read about the actual building itself. That was all the prelude to the construction phase, and that's what we're going to be covering. So we're going to be covering several chapters tonight, but they're fairly short, and you'll see why we're blazing through those three. But if you're there in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, we'll begin with verse 1 of chapter 3. It says, "Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father at the place that David had appointed on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. He began to build in the second month of the fourth year of his reign." Back in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, if you recall, David had sinned by trying to take a census of the people. And we explored that whole, you know, thing, what the big deal was on that, but how it resulted in a plague coming on the people of Israel. And so if you remember how that went down, David appealed to God for mercy, and he was told to go to the top of a hill in Jerusalem and offer a sacrifice. And so this all happened. He met with the Lord there at the threshing floor of Ornan, a guy that had this property there. So David bought the property for him. Remember, the guy was going to just give David the property, but he said, "No, I'm not going to do that. Far be it from me to do that. I have to buy it with a price." And so he offered sacrifices to God. Actually, the guy was offering him the animals for the sacrifice. That was what David wasn't going to allowed to do. And anyway, God responded, if you remember the story, by sending fire from heaven. And so David kind of figured this was a pretty special place all of a sudden. That's, you know, that's one of those kind of things, like, you know, this is special. So that's where he had determined that the temple was going to be built at that time. And the hill that they're on is significant in Israel's history anyway. Mount Moriah is the same place where Abraham had been told many, many years before to take his only son Isaac up and sacrifice him there. So he took him up there. Remember, God intervened and stopped, and he found a ram with its horns caught in the thicket, and there was God had provided a substitutionary atoning sacrifice, or substitute sacrifice. So it's interesting that this place where a substitute sacrifice was found by Abraham becomes now the place where the continual substitutionary atoning sacrifices will be taking place for Israel. So the actual work of the building gets started, but it says not until Solomon had been reigning for 4 years. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to kind of read through these things and you kind of miss the significance of some of these things, but you think about this. I mean, it just makes you realize how huge of a project this was, because at the end of 1 Chronicles, David had gotten all the stuff prepared. I mean, so many of these things were already pre-done. It was a turnkey operation, and yet it still took 4 years to actually begin the process of it. So 4 years to really break ground for the foundation to be laid. So we get on to verse 3. "These are Solomon's measurements for the building of the house of God. The lengths in cubits of the old standard was 60 cubits, and the breadth 20 cubits. A cubit is roughly 1.5 feet. So the length of the temple. Now, remember, I am not the math guy. So I'm basing this on the things that I read. If I'm telling you the wrong thing and you're the math people out here checking my math, well, then you deserve something, the prize of some kind. But either way, if the math is off, honestly, I don't care. But it's one of those things. Basically, the length of the temple, according to what I've read, is 90 feet and the width was 30 feet. So, you know, if I'm wrong on the numbers on that, just provide me with the right numbers and I'll ignore them. Keep going. Verse 4. The vestibule in the front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and its height was 120 cubits. He overlaid it on the inside with pure gold. The nave he lined with cypress and covered it with fine gold and made palms and chains on it. He adorned the house with settings of precious stones. The gold was the gold of Paravim. That's possibly, they say that it's somewhere in Syria, and it's possible that it had a reddish hue. I don't know how they would know that. That's what I read. Who knows? So he lined the house with gold, its beams, its thresholds, its walls, its doors, and carved cherubim in the walls. And he made the most holy place. Its length corresponding to the breadth of the house was 20 cubits, and its breadth was 20 cubits. He overlaid it with 600 talents of fine gold. The weight of gold for the nails was 50 shekels. And he overlaid the upper chambers with gold. In the most holy place, he made two cherubim of wood and overlaid them with gold. The wings of the cherubim together extended 20 cubits. One wing of 5 cubits touched the wall of the house, and its other wing of 5 cubits touched the wing of the other cherub. And of this cherub, one wing of 5, you get the idea. The other is all crossed. It just joins across. Verse 13. And that's the kind of stuff that drives me nuts about ancient writing, because they just do this kind of stuff. But, you know, it's the way it is. The wings of these, verse 13, was the wings of these cherubim extended 20 cubits. The cherubim stood on their feet facing the nave, or facing the entrance of the temple. So the construction, remember, the construction of the temple itself is of stone. And then they lined the interior of that with wood, and then they covered the wood over with gold. That's the way it was. So the interior part of the temple, when you walk in, is gold all the way around you. It's glittering gold everywhere. They even used gold nails on the Holy of Holies to fasten all these pieces together and stuff. It's amazing. And here we can kind of see an artist's conception of what this would have looked like in the interior. As you can see, there's just gold on everything, and it's... and then what we're looking into here is the Holy of Holies. I guess you'd be looking over on this side. The Holy of Holies with the golden cherubim. You see the golden cherubim on the walls and the palms there on the walls. And then inside the Holy of Holies, the golden cherubim that were there, two giant ones in there. It was all meant to represent. Everything about this, on the interior of this, is meant to represent the way things would be in God's realm. These amazing, immense creatures and beings, and all of this carries with it the weight or the sense of authority of something majestic and heavenly. And so here, you know, you've got all of this gold flashing around, and the angelic creatures all around. So it's all of this with the temple, remember, is meant to represent the idea of God's presence in the midst of humanity. It was an indication. The temple is an indication of God's manifest presence, a place where heaven and earth overlap. That was the concept behind it. So this is a running theme throughout the Bible, the separation of the created world and God's dwelling place, the heavens, and God's intent on reuniting it. I mean, if you really want to get an overview of what we're talking about when we talk about the biblical record, this is what it's about. It begins with this story of heaven and earth being separated at the fall. And everything from that point is all about God's intent to reunite these two, to reinfuse this earth with his presence and the dwelling place of God. It says that he made a veil of blue and purple and crimson fabrics and fine linen and worked the cherubim on that. Now, that would have been the separating point between the Holy of Holies and the main temple area. So that was the idea behind the Holy of Holies. It's basically a cube in the middle of the temple, and nobody goes in there. Only one person, the high priest, could go into that area, and even then only once a year with the on the Day of Atonement. So, I mean, you think about, that's an interesting thing. I mean, all of this, the detail that goes into this, these giant carved things, And all of this, and it's not something that everybody gets to go and ooh and ah over on a regular basis. Not like the monuments that we have in Washington or something. This was something that one dude got to go in and think about it. If you were a woman back in those days, nobody got it. None of you guys got to see it ever. But it was, you know, it's one person once a year could go in there and see that. And it's actually, that curtain is possibly one of the most tragic symbolic elements of the temple that there is, because it's identifying this heavy separation between God and the created order, God and the human race. It's basically there to protect a fallen and unrighteous humanity from God's perfection and righteousness. So this curtain that's there in the temple was a necessity of the fall. It was mandated because of man's fallen state, and he couldn't be in the presence of a holy God. That's why it's such a wonderful detail that's provided to us in the Gospels, that when Jesus died on the cross, if you remember the Gospel story at all, that in Matthew 27, the curtain tears from the top to the bottom, and in that tearing carries with it the idea that symbolic separation that was there, that was representative of a real separation, was removed by God through the atoning sacrifice of Jesus. That his atonement made once for all sins, is the way that we are now able to come freely before God. And there's nothing now. And that we've made an extensive, well, the writer of Hebrews made an extensive point of that when we were studying Hebrews. The idea that now we come boldly before God. There's nothing that separates us from him. That's why I believe our enemy works overtime to try to convince us that there is a separation there, to get us to back away from God when we mess up or whatever. But those sins, past, present, and future, that were associated with our lives have been removed because of the atonement of Jesus. And now there's nothing that keeps us from God, nothing that separates us. We come freely before God just like Adam and Eve in the creation story before the fall. There's nothing that keeps us from him. Verse 15, in the front of the house, he made two pillars, 35 cubits high, with a capital of 5 cubits on top of each, a capital, you know, a topping on it. He made chains like a necklace and put them on the tops of the pillars, and he made 100 pomegranates and put them on the chains. He set up the pillars in the front of the temple, one on the south, the other on the north. The one that on the south he called Yachin, and that on the north he called Boaz. So here again, you get an image of what that was. There was one on either side, these pillars. And they were so impressive that they're actually given names, you know. There's nothing in my house that I would ever give a name. It's not that impressive. But this is impressive enough that we got Yachin, which means he will establish, and Boaz, which means in it is strength. So the idea behind these two pillars is they represent stability and strength for the Israelite as they're coming into the temple, as they enter into that and they're moving towards that temple mount. You're reminded again that God's the one who established them as his people, and that he is the one that provides them the strength to be, to exist as God's people. He's the one who not only establishes it, but sustains their relationship with him. The strength to endure and to continue as his covenant people is provided by God. And again, it's just a reminder, all of this is, you know, from him, through him, and to him. This is the working of God, not our efforts or our abilities. It's interesting because in Revelation 3:12, as Jesus is talking to John the Revelator, you know, he's getting this amazing vision of Jesus, and Jesus is, you know, kind of like looking like a Super Saiyan. I mean, he's just, you know, just blazing and talking, and he's describing the states of the various states of the church. But then he describes, you know, what it's going to be like for those who continue on with him. And at one point he says, whoever overcomes, the one who overcomes will be made a pillar in the temple of my God. And it's probably an allusion to this thing here, the temple pillars that were there. And reminding us that the church now is the temple of God, and how the church has been provided this same stability, this same endurance by God, the establishment that he's given us. And it reminds us then that we're made into these pillars. So it's God that's provided it, but the church then becomes that means of finding the strength and endurance and stability that people crave so much within life. This is provided by Christ. That's one of the key features of the gospel, is how it does provide us with stability for life. stability and strength in the presence of God. So that's what's represented in there. Okay, we'll move on to chapter 4. It says he made an altar of bronze, 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 10 cubits high. So when a person would come up to the Temple Mount, where the whole courtyard was, the first thing that they would be encountering out there was this gigantic altar. And this is an artist's representation of what it may have looked like. The Hebrew word for altar comes from the root word that means to slay. So an altar is a place basically of killing. It was where the sacrifices for sin were made. All the way through, the enormity of what sin has caused, what this disruption to God's original intent has resulted in, always points back to this idea of death and destruction. And that's what the altar ultimately is representative of. This is the cost of sin. It was a big cube, basically, 30 feet long, 30 feet high. And it was it's such a size that it had to have a ramp or a set of stairs that found its way up there. And so this is where the sacrifices would be made. And then, of course, the blood from the various sacrifices would be taken in, like on the Day of Atonement, once a year. The blood would be taken in and sprinkled on the Ark of the Covenant. Then he made the sea of cast metal. It was round, 10 cubits from brim to brim, and 5 cubits high, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. Under it were figures of gourds for 10 cubits, compassing the sea all around. The gourds were in 2 rows, cast with it when it was cast. It stood on 12 oxen, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. The sea was set on them, and all their rear parts were inward. Its thickness was a hand's breadth, and its brim was made like the brim of a cup, like the flower of a lily. It held 3,000 baths. It also made 10 basins, about 12,000 gallons of water. He also made 10 basins in which to wash, and set 5 on the south side and 5 on the north side. In these they were rinse off what was used for the burnt offering, and the sea was for the priests to wash in. So again, we've got this out there in front of the actual temple structure. We've got this basically like a huge freestanding pool, like a doughboy, but made out of bronze. It's 15 feet in diameter, 7.5 feet deep, and it had these decorative gourds cast into it all the way around it. And as it described, the base was made up of these oxens all pointing outward in the 4 directions of the compass. The sea may have been representative of the Red Sea crossing. The 12 bulls may be representative of the 12 tribes of Israel. Oddly, though, the most ancient rabbinical text that we have in describing Solomon's temple doesn't attribute the bulls to the 12 tribes of Israel, but actually attributes it to the 12 signs of the zodiac. So you go figure. I don't know. Those writings date back to the time of the Babylonian exile, and it could very well be that their location had a strong influence on their interpretation of their own history at that point. So however you want to figure it, but I mean, that's apparently the way they saw it. It's fascinating, though, because these bulls, this is just an interesting thing to me. These bulls like this appear all the time throughout the ancient world's religions. You'll find them all the time within the Assyrian religion, within the Canaanite religions, and every time they're represented as fertility symbols, as best as we can understand. Moses instructed them to build a laver, like basically a large basin like this, but it wasn't as big as this one was. And when God instructed Moses to build it, he had him put it on, he says, a foot or on a stand. Basically, how we transitioned from a stand to these bulls, I don't know. That's a fascinating thing to me. How did we get from like a little pedestal stand to these things that, you know, could be interpreted all kinds of strange ways? Here's what's really interesting to me. The scriptures never really explain to us what all this stuff is about. I mean, the symbolism behind this. I mean, we know what it's for. The priests are going to wash up in this thing, you know, before they do the various rituals and stuff, but the significance of the various carvings and stuff like that is all the information on that is left out for some reason, which I don't know why, but I find that delightful. I like that because I like that this is something big and imposing right here in the narrative, but it's placed there without any explanation whatsoever, which gives us plenty of room to have mystery when it comes to, you know, to allow for mystery when it comes to how it is that we're dealing with God, or how it is that he's unfolding his plans, not only in our lives, but in this world. You know, here's this big old honking deal here, and we don't even know why it's like it is. It's just there, and kind of roll with it. So, I don't know. I like that. I like when I'm seeking to discover God's purposes, to realize that just some things are going to be there, and I'm not going to have an explanation for the whole thing. Now, the portable wash basins, as you see there, I don't know that they looked like that. That looks like something out of a carnival to me, but I don't know. They might have. Who knows? But anyway, they were there for the priests to wash the various instruments and things like that that they would use, the various tools and stuff that they would be using for the sacrifices and all. Verse 7, he made 10 golden lampstands as prescribed and set them in the temple, 5 on the south side, 5 on the north. He also made 10 tables and placed them in the temple, 5 on the south side, 5 on the, you guessed it, the north. And then he made 100 basins of gold. He made the court of the priests and the great court and the doors for the court and overlaid their doors with bronze. And he set the sea at the southeast corner of the house. Okay, so in the tabernacle that wandered with the children of Israel during the Exodus period, during the time, years of wandering, the tabernacle that they built was a temporary version of this, although they were never instructed to actually build this, but they had that, and that was instructed by God. And that one only had had one lamp. Now we've moved, and it says as instructed, which is curious to me, because Moses had been given the instructions to put a lamp in there, and we've moved from 1 to 10. And again, there's no real explanation. I'm not sure of the significance in the increase, except maybe because the size has increased and you need a little more light to know what you're dealing with in there. The tables, there was only one table in the original tabernacle, and again, now we've got 10 of them. And that was to place the showbread on. And what the showbread was is every Sabbath the priests would go in and they would trade out bread. They would place 12 loaves of bread in there and every Sabbath they would go in and replace those. It just as a reminder that to the Jewish people that God is the basis source of our basic elemental needs, such as bread. And then he made the small gold bowls, 100 of those, and that was for the priestly ritual purifications that they would have to do. Sprinkling bowls, they were called. Then we've got the court, and this is kind of an overview. When he's talking about the court of the priests, basically he's talking about the interior of this temple area. Not the Holy of Holies, but that main interior area, that is for the priests. That was where the priests could go. Remember, not into the Holy of Holies, but they could, you know, hang out and do their stuff in the main area. And then when it's talking about the outer court or the great court, that's this outside area here that's surrounded all around the temple area. And that's where everybody could go, or the, you know, all the Jewish people could assemble there or whatever. I mean, everybody who was properly purified could go there and hang out there and assemble there for different things. So that's basically an overview of what it looked like. This is what they built. Hiram also made, verse 11, Hiram also made the pots and the shovels and the basins. So Hiram finished the work that he did for King Solomon on the house of God. The two pillars, the bowls, the two capitals on top of the pillars, the two lattice works to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on top of the pillars. 13 is the number of the verse. And the 400 pomegranates. Well, you got all these numbers rolling in here. My mind's just swimming at this point. 400 pomegranates for the two lattice works and 2 rows of pomegranates for each lattice work to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on the pillars. He made the stands also and the basins on the stands and the 1 sea and the 12 oxen underneath it, the pots, the shovels, the forks, all the equipment for these Hiram Abi made of burnished bronze for King Solomon for the house of the Lord. In the plain of the Jordan, the king cast them in the clay ground between Sukkoth and Zaradah. So this is basically just a quick inventory of everything that Hiram had built and done. This is the guy that was sent by the king of Tyre to go in and do these sort of things, to design and build these sort of things. So what we had here in these last few verses is kind of like the bonus material on a DVD. It's giving you a little quick inventory of the whole thing, a little background on where they put up the workshop to do the casting of all of these different things. It's all the metal pieces were done over there. So that's just kind of a little bonus info bit there, just explaining all of that. Verse 18. Solomon made all these things in great quantities, for the weight of the bronze was not sought. What that means is there was so much bronze used that they couldn't even keep track of it. It was just, they, you know, were counting, and finally they said, forget it. This is just too much. We don't even know. So Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of God, the golden altar, the tables for the bread of presence, the lampstands and their lamps of pure gold to burn before the inner sanctuary as prescribed, the flowers, the lamps, and the tongs of purest gold, the snuffers, basins, dishes for incense, and fire pans of pure gold, and the sockets of the temple and the inner doors to the most holy place, and the doors for the nave of the temple were of gold. Now, this seems just like a lot of unnecessary description, and maybe it is for us being 21st century Americans so far removed from this whole thing. But we have to remember the target audience that this is being written down for. These are people who've just come back from the Babylonian Empire, most likely are surveying a wasteland of their hometown of Jerusalem. They're looking at the ruins of the temple. So for them, this is important stuff. To them, this is rekindling their imagination of what it was and what it could be again. So going over all of these various things was very important for them to not only to charge their imaginations, but also fire their desire to get in there and do the hard work of rebuilding the temple. I mean, this most likely meant to emphasize the importance of this task that they're just getting ready to undertake. So we moved on to verse 5. Thus, all the work that Solomon did for the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated and stored the silver, the gold, and all the vessels in the treasuries of the house of God. So the temple is finished with construction, and that didn't feel like it took all that long. I mean, that was pretty quick. Except that 1 Kings 9 tells us that this project took 20 years to complete. So you think about this. Solomon was a king for 4 years before they broke ground and started the whole construction project. And so now he's been a king for almost 25 years, almost a quarter of a century. And that's an amazing thing to me. If you recall, the last part of 1 Chronicles, David had stored up a lot of stuff for the temple before he died. He put a lot of things together, consecrated a lot of things. And so now, after all this time, you know, almost 24, we figure from the time that David was putting all this stuff together, 25 years easily have elapsed, maybe even more. And you know, you could almost think about this. Think about the people that maybe were tasked with lugging all this stuff into the various places that they had to store it in. And looking at it, maybe over the years, maybe 5, 10 years later, they go and they open the storehouse and they look in there and they're saying, yep, that's all that stuff David was so adamant that we had to get together and throw in there and look at it. It's just in there and it's gathering dust. And what good is it? I mean, this stuff was important stuff and it's not even being used. And I think about that, how sometimes we can recognize gifts that we have, things that, significant things that God has placed either in our hearts or in our lives, and we can get frustrated sometimes because we get excited and we think we should be able to use this. We should be able to do this stuff. You know, this is all just going to waste. It's sitting here on the sideline wanting to know, you know, when is God finally going to use me in that sense that we feel called to? But some things, as we see even here, just take time. When the time is right, when the time is right, God has his way of bringing it together, of putting it into its proper place, of putting it in that position where now it's going to be useful. And all of that time, those 25 years that it sat dormantly, doesn't mean anything, because once it's finally brought in, and once it's there and put to use, the glory of the thing is revealed. So we got to be patient. We got to trust in God's timing in the things that he's doing, even in our own lives. Then Solomon, verse 2, assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' houses and the people of Israel in Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is in Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled before the king at the feast that's in the seventh month. So this little bit of information here, the Ark, remember, it's not in the temple. They're building the temple up on the high mount there. The Ark is being stored somewhere else in another tent that David had put up. So now they're having this big celebration where they're going to bring the Ark all the way up through the city of David on into the temple mount there. And this last bit of information puts this into a chronological context for us. The Feast of the Seventh Month is the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They still do that to this day. Observant Jewish people still do it to this day in Jerusalem, where they live outside of their houses for 7 days. They build themselves little booths or little, you know, huts out of palm branches and things like that. It's meant to harken back to the days that they lived as wanderers during the years of the Exodus, after the Exodus, and they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. So that's a week-long celebration that takes place in the fall, somewhere between September and October. So it's the fall, and we know then that it's right around, as best we can put together, right around 959 BC. So part of the feast that year, when you think about this is something that they wanted to do regularly and all, and this is something that the Jewish people remembered, but this year was going to be a special year because it was this year that they dedicate the temple. So there's so much that's added to all of the celebration. You know, it's an appropriate thing when you consider that the tabernacle was the main feature of their lives as wanderers, as nomads in the desert. And now here it is fixed, reaffirming the promises that God had made, that he was going to bring them into this land, that he was going to establish them as a nation. And now here it's all finally come together in this glorious moment when the temple is built, they're dedicating it, they're bringing the Ark of the Covenant back up into the place. Verse 4, all the elders of Israel came and the Levites took up the Ark and they brought up the Ark, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. The Levitical priests brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they couldn't be counted or numbered. And again, here's this, you know, he's done this once before, way back, you know, at the outset, first at his inauguration and all. You know, so many sacrificed animals that they couldn't even be counted. That's staggering when you consider it. Again, you just don't even understand how this was accomplished in a day, but either way, they did this. And, you know, this excessive display, though, was meant to demonstrate just how much this meant to Solomon. This was an important thing. An agrarian culture like that, this isn't taken lightly. This was significant, this was meaningful, this was an extravagant expense that they went to demonstrate, for Solomon to demonstrate exactly how important this was, what this meant to him. Now, we, of course, kind of freak out and shake our heads in disgust. You know, this is alarming. This is gory. What's their problem? But then, of course, we have to remember that in our culture, we slaughter way more cattle than that. And that's just so that we can eat at McDonald's whenever we want to. So I don't think we have any sort of moral high ground, really, to look down on what happened here. The heart behind this was far better than wanting our next Happy Meal. The heart behind this was to extravagantly demonstrate how precious this moment was to Solomon, and then on Solomon representing all of Israel, how precious this was to them to be able to have this place, this overlap of heaven and earth, this meeting place with God among his people. That was an important thing to them, something that sometimes we can lose sight of, just how important it is that God's called us to be the temple, how it is that he dwells among us, how very little we seem inclined to sacrifice at all for the great honor of being his temple. Verse 7, and then the priests brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place, underneath the wings of the cherubim. So they, you know, remember those giant things that are in there, they placed it right there in the middle, underneath those wings. The cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim made a covering above the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the pole were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they couldn't be seen from the outside, and they're there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets that Moses had put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Somewhere along the line, some things got removed from there. There used to be a jar of manna in there. There was Aaron's rod that had budded, and the tablets of stone. Now, at this point that they're describing it, those other items were missing from it. We don't know how or why or when, but they, at that point, had just gotten the tablets of stone in there. Again, everything's over the top. The poles that they used to transport the ark were so long that they stretched from one end of the Holy of Holies to the other. So they were just, if you couldn't roller skate in there or anything, because you'd have to duck down every time you went around the poles. I don't know why you'd roller skate in there anyway. But now, this is interesting to me, because if Ezra wrote this account, what does it mean that the poles were there to this day? Because everything was destroyed by the Babylonians during the exile. When they came in, they took everything away or they destroyed everything. So what is he talking about here? Most believe that he's repeating the old historic accounts of what it was. So that's why he's describing what the last history that they have of it. That's what they had said in that time frame of what it was like. Or it could just even be the wording could be meant to convey that was what it was like right up until the day that it was carried off. It stayed that way. In other words, the Israelites themselves had not disrupted this. This is not, when it was placed there, it wasn't moved until the invasion of Babylon. That may be what they're trying to communicate in that. Verse 11, when the priests came out of the holy place, for all the priests who were present had consecrated themselves without regard for their divisions, and all the Levitical singers, Asaph, Heman, and Yedutun, their sons and kinsmen, arrayed in fine linen with cymbals and harps and lyres, stood east of the altar with 120 priests who were trumpeters. Remember, before David died, there were so many priests in the land of Israel that they had to categorize them, number them, and put them into various divisions so that they would rotate in, that everybody get a shot. Usually it's a once-in-a-lifetime shot that you get to go in there and perform priestly duties, because there were just so many of them, so it was a rotating order of service. But on this day, it says that they're all there, they're all gathered together, they're all ceremonially cleansed and purified and ready for service. They're all there, and just this huge amount of priests on hands, and they're all armed with songbooks and instruments ready to go. Verse 13, it was the duty of the trumpeters and the singers to make themselves heard in unison in praise and thanksgiving to the Lord. And when the song was raised with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments in praise to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever, the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests couldn't stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. So all at once, they're all gathered there. You got to see it in your mind's eye. All these people gathered around, and there was an appointed time where they were going to raise up a ruckus. They were going to sing, and all in unison, start to blow the trumpets and to bang on the drums and hit power chords on the electric guitar. And just one big wall of sound was supposed to go up in praise to God. And they're singing and declaring how faithful God is, how good God is. And that must have been an awesome moment. This is a day before rock bands or things like that, but you can get enough people together with enough percussion instruments and trumpets, you can actually get a pretty impressive noise to go up. And so here, I look at this and I think about what it is that this represents, because God loves unity among his people. And there's this constant theme of raising unified voices up in praise and singing throughout the whole Bible. Always when God's people are gathered, there's this idea of coming together in a unified sense of singing and worshiping God. I mean, God clearly digs that. And in our times, here's a community, a church community, our times of worship through song provide us that opportunity to be of one voice. I mean, there's not many things we have like that in life. When you think about it, we all kind of live our own separate lives. We all go do these things. We do our best to try to stick together and be together with community. But there's these moments when we get together and we're all saying the same thing, praying the same thing, using the same words, calling out to God and praising God for his faithfulness. That's the way God wants it. That's something God likes. There's power in that unity of God's people getting together to worship that way. That's why all the petty, ungodly worship war stuff is just so offensive. Because people will say, oh, I don't like that worship song, or I'm not into that worship team, or whatever. I don't like this style, or I'll just wait, and then I'll come in when all the worship stuff is over, and I'll just sit around and listen to the teaching or whatever. And to me, that is just rank carnality. That's nothing short of that. That sort of stuff, that attitude doesn't fit with the nature of the church, the idea of God's people assembling together in worship and adoration of God. Our time of praise and community singing are in response to God's goodness towards us. And he's the one who wants a unified voice. He's the one who calls for that. This was never meant to be something to entertain us. And I think we've lost sight of that. I think our culture, our church culture, especially here in the United States, has lost sight of what this is all about. It's all about entertainment right now, what styles I like and what's going to make me feel good at the moment. And I don't know. I think we got to re-examine that and reconsider what our motives are and what we're thinking when we're doing this, because there's power behind the unified raising of voices. Psalm 133:1, behold how good and pleasant it is when brothers and sisters dwell together in unity. God wants that. He desires that. And here in this account, as all the priests and the people are in unity, praising God for his goodness and his unrelenting, eternal love, God steps in and takes over the service. I love that part of this whole thing. I mean, when we think about everything that we've been reading in this whole chapter about all the stuff and all the steps that they're taking to do this really cool thing for God, and they've got all their pieces in place. They got all the instruments. They got everything they want to do. And the minute they begin in unity like that, God's glory shows up and they can't do anything else. They're just, oh, okay, this is actually your service. So we'll just be quiet here for a minute. This is the cloud that shows up here. In Jewish tradition, it's called the Shekinah glory. That's not a biblical term, but it's a word. It means God's dwelling or God's presence in there. It's the cloud that, it's like the cloud that appeared in the Exodus story that came and covered the tabernacle. You know, all the cool preparations and everything that were put into place, and they couldn't end up doing all the stuff they had planned out because God came and he took that over. And I don't know, that's the thing we always have to remember about church, about life, about anything like that. If we're surrendered to God, if we're submitting our lives to his will, which is what it means to be a follower of Jesus, we're surrendering our lives to his rulership over that, then, you know, sometimes our carefully crafted ideas are not necessarily going to, you know, whether that's for worship or for life or our plans or whatever, sometimes they're going to get usurped. And it doesn't necessarily mean that's a bad thing. This was not a bad thing that happened here. It didn't get to go down the way they'd practiced it. You know, the choir director's like, wow, you know, I spent a year working on this whole program, but it's still a good thing because God's presence in there, it's just turned into something else, turned into something that God is revealing himself in a new way. And that's what we have to understand. Sometimes these disruptions that happen, all these carefully laid out plans, whether it's for worship or whether it's for life or whatever, sometimes this is God showing up in a unique way to give us a different perspective that we hadn't had before. And when our lives are submitted to him and surrendered to him, we need to pay attention to the fact that he may be up to things. It's, you know, when God is on the move, it's always surprising when he shows up in our lives. So with all that we do, let's make it a priority to seek God's purposes and to hold our plans a little less tightly and allow for the possibility that God has something else that he wants to do in revealing himself and his ways to us as we're seeking God. Let's not be surprised if we suddenly find him in that, when he shows up in those surprising ways to dwell with us. Right on? Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for the story that we have of Israel, and in the way that you laid the foundation, the roadways that lead to Jesus. We thank you, God, that while we can look at this and be amazed at all that went into it, we have something so far superior in our relationship with Jesus. Now there's nothing that separates you from us. No more animals are sacrificed because the one perfect sacrifice was made for us. I pray that we don't ever take that for granted, that we don't ever lose sight of the significance and important and wonder of what it is that you've provided for us. Help us, God, as we carry on this journey in following you. Be with us, I pray, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.